disappear and replaced by the good. It's never worked that way. What you have to have is an analysis of what's actually going on. And the unanimity, the dominance of the United States is over. And the whole world is trying to figure out, every company in the world, every country, how do you navigate a new international order? The United States is pretending that, as a nation, it doesn't have to worry about this. And I'm afraid Patrick's remarks will lead people to think, well, there's problems on their side too, which there are. But that misses the larger historical phenomena. This is the first serious economic competition this country has faced, and the consequences of that will be overwhelming to us.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Richard Wolff, economics professor, visiting professor at the New School, and Patrick Bond, professor at the University of Johannesburg. That does it for our show. Yes, Democracy Now! Will be in Baku, Azerbaijan, covering the UN Climate Summit in mid-November. And tune in on election night, Tuesday, November 5th, for a four-hour Democracy Now! Election special, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Join us from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern, and any television or radio station can take the broadcast as well. We'll also be airing an expanded two-hour election show on Wednesday, November 6th. That does it for our show. Check out our job listings at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's Folk Music Programs.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, investigations on campaign finance find Rubio free of violations.
Portlanders prepare to rank candidates on their November ballot.
And OHSU President Dr. Danny Jacobs resigns amidst hospital's financial turmoil.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 25th, 2024. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Hannah Francis. Portland mayoral candidate Carmen Rubio's campaign didn't violate election rules, the auditor's office says. The office looked into two complaints and found no wrongdoing. There have been five investigations around campaign finance in the recent election cycle. All have been around only two candidates, Carmen Rubio and Rene Gonzalez, both city commissioners who are running for mayor. The city auditors announced on October 15th that the two investigations into Carmen Rubio's campaign finances yielded no violations. One allegation was that Carmen Rubio had been using her commissioner office's resources to tout Rubio's campaign and successes. The investigation found no supporting evidence for these claims, stating that there was nothing outside the scope of a city commissioner's office and that there was nothing related to Rubio's campaign. The other investigation concerned a Portland for All promotional video for Rubio. The complaint alleged that there was no financial disclosure in the video. The investigation found that Portland for All made this video without Rubio's participation and was made by a volunteer with footage from a previous event. However, this did bring to light that the Political Action Committee, otherwise known as PAC, managed by Portland For All may not be logging all of its donations properly with the Oregon Secretary of State. Portland For All says that they'll cooperate in further investigations by the auditor. In Gonzalez's case, the auditor dismissed a complaint about an outdated yard sign that was improperly displayed on public property. Gonzalez's campaign said that a supporter likely placed the sign and it was promptly removed. The city auditor looked into a more serious allegation about the commissioner as well. They found Gonzalez's campaign in violation of campaign finance rules because he used taxpayer money to pay his staff to edit his Wikipedia page for campaign purposes.
Portland will be using ranked choice voting to elect 12 new city councilors, its mayor, and its city auditor on November 5th. And for councilors, there will be multiple winners in each district's race, the three most popular in the district. Counting these ballots, or tabulating them, is a bit more complex than normal, but it's something the county elections office has been working on for a couple years. Each winning city council candidate needs to earn 25% plus one of the votes in their district. That's the threshold. Voters will have the ability to rank six candidates total. Votes will be counted in rounds. In each round, the candidate with the least votes is eliminated and their votes redistributed to their supporters' next ranked choice. One of the selling points of ranked choice voting is that it allows people to support candidates they really care about, even if they may not be the most likely to win. But in the multi-winner races, voters shouldn't be afraid of ranking popular candidates highly for fear of wasting their vote. If a candidate reaches the threshold, their excess support or surplus votes get proportionally distributed to their second choice. That helps to ensure that the three winners are the three most popular candidates from the district. The city council winners in Portland will also likely take some time to determine. Ranked choice voting needs all the ballots to be collected and counted before calling a race. How many ballots are turned in and tabulated by election night depends on voters. Some estimates based on past trends would indicate 50 or 60% of votes will be in by that time. Even though final results will take some time to count, Multnomah County Elections will release regular updates on the ballots they've counted so far, with information on who is leading the races. More information on the process is available online at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
Oregon Health and Science University President Dr. Danny Jacobs will resign, citing personal reasons. The OHSU board is expected to name School of Medicine Dean Nate Selden to the post for a three-year term today. Governor Tina Kotek seems to think that that's too fast. A spokesperson wrote in an email earlier today, quote, "The governor believes the timeline put forward to appoint a new president compromises the future of the institution, and that it would be a mistake to push through a decision of this magnitude without appropriate due diligence," end quote. Jacob says he's resigning for personal reasons. He led OHSU through the pandemic and now in two uncertain financial times. The hospital system laid off 400 employees this summer. This change also comes as OHSU is attempting to merge with Legacy Health, which would make them the largest employer in the region.
The deadly ice storm last January knocked over hundreds of trees. Experts say that preparing trees ahead of winter can protect them and property and lives. The biggest risk is not entire trees falling over, Portland City Forester Jen Cairo says. It is large branches breaking off. In the fallout of January's ice storm, falling trees and branches killed at least five people. One man died in his home in Lake Oswego. A second man died in an RV, which ignited after being hit by a fallen tree. And another three people died when a branch brought a power line down onto their car. Weather experts say that with a La Nina weather system, which typically leads to cooler temperatures and more precipitation, we can expect another active winter. The Oregon Department of Forestry has advised residents to hire an expert to inspect and perform maintenance on their trees before the end of fall. Trees that are vulnerable to ice and strong winds usually have telltale signs, such as leaning in a pronounced direction, unusually discolored foliage, and heightened insect activity. Certain management practices can also lead to weakened trees that are more likely to fall. If all the lower limbs are removed, for example, this can cause the top of the tree to act like a sail, making it easier to blow down. Depending on the tree's location and size, the City of Portland may require a permit for pruning and especially for removal. A full Oregon Homeowner's Guide to Tree Care can be found online at the Oregon Department of Forestry's website.
Metro, Central City Concern, and partners will celebrate the grand opening of an affordable housing complex with a Halloween party. The new complex, Meridian Gardens, will offer 85 single-room occupancy and studio apartments to people who are in substance use disorder recovery and who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. The complex will provide 20 affordable housing-focused units and 65 permanent supportive housing units. Housing in which long-term leasing or rental assistance and supportive services are provided to assist households with a disability in achieving housing stability to Portland residents in need. This is the third development to open on Central City Concern's Division Street campus, which currently provides 283 units ranging from permanent supportive to workforce housing. The Meridian Gardens complex has been funded by two voter-passed measures: the Metro Affordable Housing Bond, providing $13.3 million for construction, as allocated by Portland Housing Bureau, and Metro Supportive Housing Services, which allocated funds from Multnomah County to provide wraparound services to residents. The celebration on Halloween Day will include speeches, building tours, bingo, a taco truck, and live music.
Doctors and nurses at Providence Hospital and Clinic in Oregon have authorized a strike if they can't come to agreement on union negotiations with the hospital system. If the doctors go on strike, it would be the first time in Oregon history. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Healthcare workers in Oregon have authorized a potential strike. It includes nurses at Providence Women's Clinic and doctors at Providence St. Vincent. If it happens, it would be the first time doctors have held a strike in Oregon history. Jeremiah Wright, a nurse practitioner at St. Vincent, says it took a long time for the doctors and other hospitalists at St. Vincent to reach the point where they felt comfortable with a strike. He says doctors' first priority is do no harm, but they have struggled to provide care because of understaffing.
Realizing that it is beholden on the corporation and the healthcare systems to ensure that we are providing the best healthcare for our patients. If it comes to a point where a strike is necessary for us to achieve that, then it's up to Providence to make sure that the hospital staffs when we're on strike.
Workers represented by the Oregon Nurses Association say they've reached an impasse with Providence over concerns about staffing and retention. Federal mediators have been called into negotiations at St. Vincent, which started in January. Providence did not respond before the deadline for this story. Christina Malongo is a clinic nurse with Providence Women's Clinic. Negotiations at her clinic began in November 2023, and there have been 36 bargaining sessions so far. She describes nurses as burnt out and the clinic as short-staffed since the pandemic. She adds Providence hasn't moved on the issues most important to her and her coworkers.
Work-life balance, competitive wages and benefits, health benefits, retirement that rewards loyalty and ensures the dignity of people as they move into retirement. Those are areas we have been really stuck.
Malongo says many nurses don't feel like they've been listened to, and so a strike authorization felt like a necessary step.
As someone who is at the bargaining table myself, I feel like the strike authorization is another tool to convey the seriousness and the unity among our union members.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Republicans defend their candidate from allegations of fascism. Trump says he'll fire Special Prosecutor Jack Smith if reelected. And California voters are poised to increase penalties for petty crime. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We've heard a lot of extreme things about Donald Trump from Donald Trump. It's really, unfortunately, with a guy like that, it's kind of baked into the vote at this point.
Republican New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu says Americans are willing to hold their nose and vote for former President Donald Trump in spite of accusations that he's a fascist. Former Trump Chief of Staff John Kelly says his old boss praised Adolf Hitler and would govern as a dictator. Trump responded by calling Kelly dumb and a bad general. Meanwhile, Trump says if reelected, he'd fire Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, ending criminal cases over trying to overturn the 2020 election and mishandling classified documents.
We got immunity at the Supreme Court. It's so easy. I would fire him within 2 seconds.
If returned to office, Trump could order the Department of Justice to drop any remaining federal charges against him. The classified documents case was recently dismissed by a Trump-appointed judge, but Smith is appealing. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Texas today, where she'll focus on reproductive rights with superstar Beyoncé. Harris has used the singer's 2016 track Freedom as an anthem and has campaigned with women hurt by restrictive Texas abortion laws. California's Proposition 36, a reaction to retail theft, is likely to pass. The ballot measure would increase penalties for drug and theft crimes, and polls show it's supported by 7 in 10 state voters. But George Galvis with the Oakland nonprofit Courage says two of the most shoplifted items are baby formula and diapers.
When we're spending $137,000 a year to incarcerate people, it really does not make sense, as opposed to just investing in programs that actually are effective.
Young voters and those new to the process in Arizona are more likely to have mail-in ballots rejected for signature errors. Jen Fifield with the Arizona Center for Investigative Journalism says election officials typically verify signatures by relying on driver's license e-signatures, which are often sloppy and incorrect.
When I talked to voters about the ballots that were rejected for this reason in 2022, they were upset.
Democrats have launched ad campaigns in Wisconsin and Arizona calling Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein a spoiler who helped elect Trump in 2016 by splintering the progressive vote. And former Green Party vice presidential candidate Rosa Alicia Clemente tells Yes Magazine the party could do better than Stein.
There's enough people out there that could grow the Green Party, but there's some people that are keeping us that are within the party from growing the way I know we can.
Stein supporters argue there's little difference between the two major parties, and if she's a spoiler, it's a sign of strength. Trump allies helped Stein with ballot access, and she's been endorsed by former Klan head David Duke for her opposition to Israel's war in Gaza. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, KBOO presents Running on Air, the daily roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. On this episode, we're speaking with City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez, who is running for mayor. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 44. Tomorrow's weather will include intervals of clouds and sunshine, a high of 65, and will be cloudy with showers tomorrow night. On this day in 1980, AC/DC had their first top 40 hit with You Shook Me All Night Long. Today's quote of the day is from Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, about the scientist turned plant monster from the swamps of Louisiana. The swamp man says, "Maybe the world has run out of room for monsters. Or maybe they're just getting harder to recognize."
President Joe Biden traveled to the Gila River Indian community to formally apologize on behalf of the United States to the countless Native families harmed by America's historic Indian boarding school policies. Recovery, cleanup, and storm damage assessments are underway in Kotzebue, Alaska, after a coastal storm flooded the community this week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Joe Biden's traveling to the Gila River Indian community Friday to formally apologize on behalf of the United States to the countless thousands of Native families harmed by America's historic Indian boarding school policies. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
President Biden's in Arizona to deliver an apology of historic proportions over past U.S. Indian boarding school policies.
Oh my gosh, I never thought I would see this in my lifetime.
That's Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first Native American in U.S. history to serve as a cabinet secretary. She's an enrolled member of the Pueblo of Laguna, who's been personally impacted by America's Indian boarding school policies from 1819 through the 70s.
Decades ago, when I was sitting at my grandmother's kitchen table and talking to her about boarding schools, she didn't tell me everything, right? I knew there was more to what she was telling me.
Like countless other Native Americans, Haaland still feels the impacts of those injustices on her ancestors, including that her great-grandpa only had a horse and wagon, even as his daughter's boarding school was some 125 miles away.
He was able to only visit her twice during the 5 years that she was there. Her time there, her dad's time at boarding school, that affected my life, and I didn't realize how much it affected my life right until I got a little bit older.
That painful family history is partly why, back in 2021, Haaland launched the administration's Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative. Part of it was a listening tour across Indian country, which is culminating with Biden's formal apology to Native Americans and Alaska Natives from coast to coast.
I hope they feel seen. I hope they feel heard by the President of the United States. It is a big deal.
Haaland says Biden's apology isn't just about formalities.
The president also restarted the White House Council on Native American Affairs. He restarted the Tribal Nations Summits. None of those things happened under the previous administration.
Critics say the apology is political because President Biden is delivering it in the battleground state of Arizona, less than 2 weeks out from the election. But Haaland brushes those barbs aside.
It's heartfelt and it's meaningful, and it will mean something to the people there. It will mean something to anyone who listens to it.
For National Native News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Recovery, cleanup, and storm damage assessments are underway in Kotzebue, Alaska, after a coastal storm flooded the community this week. The state has declared a disaster as emergency teams respond. Reporter Megan Onder spoke with Mayor Derek Haviland Lee.
What were the biggest impacts to the community?
Our actual water and sewer system fared really well. Everything stayed intact. We did have a couple of places around town where there was some damage with some leaking, but we were able to shut the water off at that source. We did have one home that the foundation was completely destroyed and the house collapsed.
What are the next steps?
The borough has taken the lead on anybody that cannot return to their home. They're finding places for them to be housed. The tribe, Kotzebue IRA, has taken the lead on donations from various entities outside of Kotzebue with food and water. The city on our side, we're heading, obviously repairing the roads that were damaged and debris cleanup in the streets. Assessors that are coming in today that is going to start going around town and documenting damage.
That was an interview by Megan Onders, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Minnesota man James Staples brings solar power and job training to North Minneapolis, hoping to uplift his whole community. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Jemez Staples of North Minneapolis started a solar company about 10 years ago, he saw it as a great opportunity to create jobs for others in his low-income neighborhood.
I thought this was going to be easy. I figured, you know, just get up, go to work, get people who wanted to work, and we'd be fine.
But he learned that there was no easy way for people in his community to get trained as solar installers. The only programs were far away or inaccessible by bus. So Staples bought a big old building in the neighborhood and turned it into a green workforce training center. The building itself is topped with solar panels, runs on electric heat pumps, and has EV charging stations. So he says it also serves as a demonstration site to get people excited about clean energy.
It's a representation of where we're going. It's a representation of what the possibilities are.
Staples' company, Renewable Energy Partners, also developed a community solar installation in the area to help people save money on energy bills. And he's partnering on a project to install solar and battery storage at local schools. He says for him, solar energy provides more than a way to make a career for himself. He believes the energy transition can help uplift his whole community.
So we collectively rise together.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Prominent Black evangelical leaders from around the country are hitting the streets, going door to door to mobilize Black communities to vote. More from Crystal Blair.
Prominent Black church leaders and faith influencers from coast to coast are taking their message beyond the pulpit and going door to door to mobilize Black communities to vote. Under the banner of the Black Church PAC, these leaders are focused on voter education and empowerment through an initiative called 100K Strong, Not for Change, Vote for Justice. The group also organizes voter registration drives, advocates for policy reforms, and pushes for changes they feel reflect the core values of the Black faith community. Pastor Mike McBride of the Way Christian Center in Berkeley, California, is co-chair of the PAC.
We have secured key commitments from key clergy members and community members to engage with 100,000 residents, knocking on their doors, dropping literature.
Pastor McBride says the Black Church PAC is focusing its efforts in six battleground states: Florida, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. He also warns the rise of social media and the spread of misinformation are actively working to suppress voters. To help counteract this trend, he says the Black Church PAC has spoken to 300,000 voters over the course of 30 tour dates.
What we want to ensure is that, particularly in swing, that we can grow the kind of universe of voters who turn out on voting day just by making sure they have the right information and the right reminder, and when needed, arrive to the poll.
Pastor McBride also acknowledges that voter intimidation at the polls is real. He says his organization has partnered with other clergy for poll watching programs to help protect voters as they wait in line to exercise their 15th Amendment right. For the United States News Service, I'm Crystal Blair.
Election Day is less than 2 weeks away, but there's still time for Washingtonians to make their final voting decisions. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The 2024 election is hitting its home stretch, and many Washingtonians have already received their ballots in the mail. Even with Election Day approaching, there's still time for people to do research and make informed decisions with their votes. Cynthia Stewart with the League of Women Voters of Washington says people can start with voter pamphlets and candidates' websites. Her organization also has a voter guide at vote411.org. She says people should make plans for how they'll return their ballots before the 8 p.m. deadline on November 5th.
We encourage people to mail their ballots in very early just to make sure they get there in time. But if somebody is voting at the last minute, there are drop boxes all over the state where people can take their ballots, and those are picked up at 8 o'clock and then they are counted.
Ballots returned in the mail and postmarked by Election Day at the latest will be counted. People can also still register to vote online until Monday. After that, they'll need to register in person at their local elections office up until 8 p.m. on November 5th. Kathy McCall with AARP Washington says candidates and campaigns should focus on the issues that older Americans care about because they vote in the largest numbers every election.
Housing, healthcare, and financial security seem to be top of mind for older adults. And that's why our individuals who are running for office this election cycle, we want to know what steps will they be taking to support older adults as they age.
McCall says policies that support Washington State's 820,000 unpaid family caregivers are also important this election.
So that if they need to have respite care or have somebody come into their home to help care for the individual that they're trying to care for so that they can have a break or that they can go to work or that they can also interact with fun activities as well.
McCall says AARP Washington doesn't endorse candidates, but it is opposing Initiative 2124, as is the League of Women Voters of Washington. The measure would make the long-term care benefits program WaCares optional for workers, which both organizations say would effectively end it because it would become financially unsustainable. Supporters say workers should be allowed to choose if they want to pay into WaCares. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Initiative 2117 on the ballot for Washingtonians this year would repeal the state's Climate Commitment Act. Opponents of the measure say it would hurt the state's fight against wildfires. More with Eric Tegedoff.
Washingtonians are voting on a measure that will decide the future of the state's climate law. Opponents of the initiative say it could hurt the state's fight against increasingly severe wildfires. Initiative 2117 would repeal Washington's cap and trade law, known as the Climate Commitment Act, which invests in climate resiliency programs with funds from the state's largest carbon emitters. Amanda Montai is a former wildland firefighter in the state and says a yes vote on the initiative repealing the Climate Commitment Act would damage efforts to protect against wildfires.
We're going to be potentially losing that $30 million in funding that's supporting things like prescribed fire, which helps reduce flammable vegetation, as well as manual treatments or mechanical treatments like using a chainsaw to cut extra vegetation or any number of other things.
The Climate Commitment Act has raised more than $2 billion since it went into effect last year. Opponents of the law, who are supporting Initiative 2117, call it a hidden gas tax for consumers and question where money raised from the law has gone. Jay Wilkins is an active firefighter and member of the Washington State Council of Firefighters. He says repealing the state's climate law would be short-sighted and make his job harder. Wilkins says one of the biggest benefits from Climate Commitment Act funds has been the prevention piece, such as grants that help homeowners harden their homes against wildfires.
What that does for us in the response part is gives us a fighting chance to save homes. It gives us a fighting chance to limit fire spread. And really, at the end of the day, shorter duration fires means less air pollution, less smoke in the air. It makes everybody's quality of life better.
Montai says there's an urgency to funding wildfire resiliency right now as the effects from climate change worsen.
We really just need all hands on deck. We need all the resources we can get. We need all the funding we can get. And this can be a sustainable and really effective funding stream for building forest health and resilience and building more fire resilient landscapes in Washington if we allow it to be.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 25th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your